This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovec. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Meta Platforms shareholders paying dearly for its spending on the metaverse. Facebook parent, the market value collapsing at least by one count, almost $700 billion this year, forcing it out of the ranks of the world's 20 largest companies. You and I keep checking out the chart. Mark Zuckerberg's fortune, we just talked about it. We had some fun. But, you know, nonetheless, it's real money, plunging by some $11 billion today alone.
Just today, more than $100 billion since September of last year. In fact, Meta Platforms stock trading right now at levels last seen, Carol, back in 2016. We've got the perfect guest to give us everything we need to know and our audience what they need to know about Meta Platforms and what it does from here on out. We got Sarah Friar with us. She's big tech team leader for Bloomberg News. She's also the author of the great book. It's called No Filter, The Inside Story of Instagram. She's in our Bloomberg 960 studio in San Francisco. Sarah, I know you worked late into the night last night with the live blog and with the team covering Meta Platforms' most recent earnings report. One thing that sticks out to me from that and Mark Zuckerberg's comments, the word patience, which I heard him utter a couple of times. It doesn't seem like investors are very patient.
No, it doesn't. It seemed like every question he was getting on the earnings call was, you know, are you sure that this is what you want to do with all of this money? And how can we as investors know that these bets that you are making are actually going to pay off? And how soon will they pay off? And Zuckerberg, he was steadfast in saying, like, listen, I like the trends I'm seeing in terms of, you know, the progress we're making. We're making progress. I can't tell you when or how big or how much will come out of this. And I think that was really not what investors wanted to hear. They wanted to hear, okay, you'll see payoff in 2 years or 5 years or something. But, you know, he couldn't make those guarantees. And that's what we're seeing reflected in the stock. It's this enormous bet, and it's a really hard time for Meta to be making a bet of this scale, given the economic environment, given the change that they're making to their entire algorithm, big changes to their legacy social platforms, so much in flux at once.
Sarah, you know, it's interesting. We had a guest just before Meta's earnings last night, Linda Yates. She's created this company called Mach49, and she's talking about, she's got a book out called The Unicorn Within, and basically how established companies have to essentially disrupt themselves and create unicorns within their own company rather than rely on buying kind of a smaller startup. And it was funny to be talking with her and digesting Meta's earnings last night. I mean, could it be that ultimately, yeah, these are companies that have to pivot because the world is changing, and this could turn out to be a really smart bet on the part of Mark Zuckerberg. I mean, how do you think about it? You've been reporting on this company and writing about it for such a long time.
Well, here's the thing. This is not a new bet by Zuckerberg. He changed the company name a year ago to Meta, but he acquired Oculus in 2014. This is something he's been saying is a 5 to 10 years out vision for more than almost 10 years in itself. So I think that lends itself a little bit to the impatience. But to your point, I think it's really important to think about the context of Meta's decision here. Mark Zuckerberg knows he can't go acquire another Instagram, acquire another WhatsApp in order to dig out of this hole and bet on the future. He needs to build it within Facebook, within Meta, and he doesn't really have a track record yet of inventing things. And that's really something that investors are grappling with here. Like he invented Facebook and then the newsfeed, I guess, is another major great invention for the advertising business. But other times he's tried to build things that are appealing to consumers. It's only worked part of the time, sometimes hasn't worked at all. Think about how many times he tried to clone Snapchat, how many times he's tried to clone TikTok before it worked out. So I think that is the hesitation here. You know, he's taking the company on this big pivot. He's turning a ship of, you know, tens of thousands of employees in this direction. Can he pull it off? Well, you know, it's hard to say. They're making a lot of innovations, but do people want them is the question.
Okay, so that's the question. And I believe it was Connor Sen, who's on our Bloomberg Opinion team. He was tweeting about this a little earlier today. I'll pull up the tweet and tweet it out after our interview, Sarah. But he basically said the idea that he's wondering if Mark Zuckerberg has had people around him who are reflecting what customers want right now. And I'm wondering what your reporting and the team's reporting can tell you about people close to him, his advisors, and where he's getting the idea that this is where they need to really bet on this.
I think that he has a lot of regrets about the fact that Meta built its entire business on the platforms that were created by Apple and Google, the phone, right? And we are seeing how risky that is with Apple's privacy changes wiping $10 billion off of Meta's revenue this year. So from a business perspective, he needs to own the next major computing platform, because if he doesn't, he will always be thinking, what is Google going to do? What is Apple going to do to ruin my business next year? Or, you know, what could they take away from me? It's just not a very, very safe strategic place for the business to be long term. So he's right about that. However, is the metaverse the next major computing platform? He thinks it is.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah, exactly. Oh my gosh. Well, investors today voting, we don't think so. Meta platform still down almost 24%. Sarah Friar, thank you so much. Bloomberg News big tech team leader. She's written so much, including the inside story of Instagram. She knows this company.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, remember the study that was all over the news earlier in the week about how kids who played 3 hours or more of video games a day perform better on tests of memory and impulse control than those who did not play games? This was a study that was released on Money. It's some food for thought. And I feel like, Tim,
was this study by kids who play video games? Is that who did this study?
Funny. That's very funny.
It seems like it.
I just think about all the things that are coming at kids right now. And, you know, things that, okay, maybe that's some upside, but there's a lot of things that have been tough when it comes to their mental health, especially coming off the pandemic.
Yeah, and we go to Dr. Tamar Mendelsohn, director of the Center for Adolescent Health at the Johns Hopkins at Bloomberg School of Public Health. Dr. Mendelsohn joins us on the phone from Baltimore this afternoon. The Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, it is supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, the founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. Dr. Mendelsohn, we wanted to talk to you because you're an expert when it comes to adolescent mental health, when it comes to child mental health as well. And coming off the pandemic and just seeing the way that kids' mental health was affected, given that here we are, you know, still more than 3 years in and COVID hasn't gone away, what are the right things for us to be focused on and keeping an eye on to make sure that we can actually undo some of the damage done over the last few years?
Absolutely. Well, first, thanks for having me on. And I feel like I always want to stress that youth mental health issues were a public health problem even before COVID. And I think it's important for us to know that because the pandemic really shone a spotlight on these mental health issues, and certainly they have been made worse during the pandemic. So I think this is a wake-up call for us to really think about how can we build in more supports for young people throughout their development so that we can really help promote wellness. And schools are one important place to do that. So states are starting to pass new policies to better support young people's mental health. And this includes being able to include mental health days where students can be absent from school for a few days without penalty for mental health reasons, funds to cover psychologists and other mental health professionals on site in schools, and also training teachers how to recognize trauma and how to respond in an effective way when they see youth trauma in the classroom.
So I do wonder, though, as you talk about this, schools are struggling just to make sure kids have all the necessary equipment that they need. Not all schools are created equal. And I feel like we continue to load so much on schools to take care of a lot when it comes to our younger generation. Doesn't that worry you a little bit about the inequities as a result and kids who maybe need some help when it comes to mental health in lower economic areas and that they might not get that?
So you're making such great points. So first, I really want to underscore what you said about inequities. The pandemic really worsened pre-existing inequities. And so what we've seen is that children growing up in low-income communities, under-resourced communities, were hit particularly hard by the pandemic and tend to experience more sort of trauma and stress. And this is especially true for Black and Native American communities. So I think we need to make sure that we are funneling resources toward young people who need them most. And then, you know, the point about schools do have a lot, they have a lot to take care of, right? And they need to really make sure that students' academics are supported and all of those things. But schools are where our young people spend most of their time. And so I think it's really key that we build these mental health and emotional supports into the way that we educate young people. And this can be done without sacrificing academic rigor or, you know, education. So there are many sort of prevention programs and mental health promotion programs, restorative justice programs that can really be embedded within schools to create a more supportive culture. And what we know from research is that school connectedness and feeling like you belong at school and you know you're supported and valued, that is actually a really strong protective factor for young people's mental health.
I totally agree, right? The payoff, you think about it, right, Tim?
Yeah.
Making sure of that.
Yeah. Dr. Tamar Mendelson, really appreciate you taking the time and joining us this afternoon. Dr. Mendelson is director of the Center for Adolescent Health at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, joining us this afternoon from Baltimore. Dr. Mendelson, the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, I should note, it is supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, the founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies.
Did you play video games a lot as a kid?
You know, it's funny. I actually watched. I was never good at video games. I was talking to a colleague about this today who plays games. I like to watch my friends play games, which is kind of funny because, you know.
Well, there's tournaments
that,
where people
do that.
Well,
nowadays there is. Like, Twitch is huge. Esports leagues are huge.
Right.
So, Carol, I was onto something.
What was the game you
were
watching?
GoldenEye. Ari knows what I'm talking about. Yeah.
He's like, thumbs up.
So.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Like a pong.
Yeah.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
You are listening and watching Bloomberg Business Week. We're streaming on Bloomberg Quick Take and on YouTube. Carol Masser along with Tim Stenovic. And, you know, I think it's interesting that we've been talking a lot about an alternate universe this week. And yes, the metaverse. But what I really think is interesting is the alternate universe, Tim, that we've been talking about when it comes to green energy and climate adaptation, right? Like we're thinking about where this all goes.
Yeah, I mean, the conversation has certainly shifted quite a bit, at least for me. And I think for on our program, Carol, just over the last, 9 months, it certainly seems like. I mean, think about the way we're talking about nuclear power right
totally.
Now, the way we're talking about power generation, and the way we're talking about climate.
Like, how do we do it? How do we power the world going forward? Well, coming up next is Andy Marsh. He's president and CEO of Plug Power, the maker of hydrogen fuel cells for industrial equipment and vehicles and so much. Joining us in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio. Andy, it is so great to have you here. Welcome.
Pleasure to be here, Carol and Tim.
We've had a lot of conversations.
We have.
I want to ask you, though, before we get into, because I know you had an event, I think it was last week, and we want to get into that. But I want to talk to you about something that earlier this month, I think you guys cut your full year revenue guidance by about 5 to 10%.
Sure.
Abandoned plans for two plants, and I think you've got some permit delays on a third facility. Tell us about the headwinds and how that changes the growth trajectory for what you guys are trying to do.
Well, Carol, when I take a step back, what we actually told the market was we're not sure whether we're going to meet our targets, and we wanted to back off just so no one was surprised. I think a couple things are important. One, we haven't lost any orders. A lot has to do with construction at our customer sites as well as supply chain with us.
Okay.
But we continue to, you know, whether some of those deals get done in the fourth quarter or the first quarter, the deals are there.
Well,
the deals are real.
Did you caution because of supply chain concerns or caution that I'm not quite sure about the economy and maybe those deals won't come through?
Oh, with supply, pure supply chain. The deals are there. And look, it's working the supply chain every day. On my drive down from Saratoga Springs this morning, I was on with supply chain issues to make sure we were addressing them. So they're real, but you know, you just have to work at it every day.
Andy, explain what the supply chain challenges are, and specifically when it comes to your business. Because we talk about supply chain challenges, and we oftentimes, you know, think about companies trying to get goods from outside the U.S., or maybe they're stuck in a rail yard somewhere.
You're sitting with the cars right there.
Yeah, what's going on with Plug Power?
So, you know, it's interesting. So, simple item, you would think fans are really easy to get, right? So, I was on the discussion on the way down about fans that come from Germany, and the issues actually integrate circuits, right? So in fans themselves, there's controllers.
Is that a chip?
That's a chip.
Okay.
Issue.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
So,
I'm too much of an engineer, Tim.
But I guess I use the term chip like, you know, kind of overarching.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was a chip. And that was a part which had a 3 week lead time and now is
chips.
You know, 51 week lead time that you have to work through. It, you know, was never a problem any other years, but you figure it out.
So what about the abandoning plans for two plants?
Yeah, so two plants.
And that's done?
So, you know, first I want to, you know, I talked to one of the analysts at our event said to me, Andy, you know, this moving a quarter, not really a big deal in the big picture. Right? You know, we're building this 500-ton green hydrogen plant across the United States. We'll have Georgia done before the year's out. Mm-hmm. We were down there with the senator from Georgia yesterday going over the plan as they were looking at the hydrogen hub for Georgia. New York was delayed a bit because of associated with some permitting issues. Those things come up. Permits are in place. Tougher to build in the winter than it is to build in the spring. And we'll start going full construction in the spring and be up the third quarter with that plant.
So still on track to hit, I think it was a forecast of, was it 200 tons per day of carbon-free fuel by the end of 2023?
You got it.
Still on track. Great.
Still on track.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hey, Andy, we talk about this all the time when you join us. It seems like pretty much, you know, twice a year, four times a year. We love having you, by the way. Amazon, Walmart, Home Depot, Kroger, they are your biggest customers.
Yeah.
What are you hearing from them? We got Amazon earnings after the bell today. What do you hear from Amazon?
Oh, interesting. I would say, no, Amazon presented at our symposium last week.
Which is last week, yeah.
And they talked about all the applications that they're looking, you know, they're committed to their 2040 goals, regardless of what all the, where all the noise is. They signed a deal for 30 tons a day of green hydrogen with us. They're looking at vehicles with us, with our JV, with Renault in France.
Yeah.
We're looking at stationary products with them to back up data centers. So none of that, all those discussions and movements going, and we're going to have a big year with Amazon this year. We're going to have a big year with Amazon next year with different products, too. So it's not just, you know, their goals, to meet their goals is really critical to them.
Well, Andy, when you think about some of the people that you partner with or your big clients, like when we talk about the move towards green, and we constantly have every day on Bloomberg our green vertical and our green reporting team, you know, talking about the climate's getting warmer. We're seeing it this week, like,
yeah.
In terms of, you know, and the impact of it. So do you feel like in terms of the move towards alternative fuels and what you guys are doing, are we, like, when is the tipping point going to happen? Because the big oil giants, they're doing well too, and we're still going to be tapping them for some time.
And we have to be smart about this.
But what does that mean? What does that mean?
Look, you can't. I'll give you a quick one. You know, we have infrastructure in this country, which the fossil fuel companies have developed, mm-hmm. which could be leveraged for renewables, i.e., natural gas pipelines. Could easily use hydrogen mixed in their pipelines. I mean, you can't just, you know, there's activities with carbon capture that has to go on,
right?
That to help protect the environment. To think that all these assets are going to go away instantaneously overnight, I don't think it's very smart. I mean, I'll give you another example. I sit on a board of a company called Gevo, mm-hmm. which does sustainable aviation fuel, which can go into a long-distance aircraft.
What is sustainable aviation fuel?
So it's kind of biofuels. So you would take something like corn, like ethanol, and you process it a little bit differently to get a higher octane level.
But it still creates emissions.
It creates emission, but you have a zero carbon cycle because you go grow again. Right, so you have to think about Tim.
Yeah, but we need to stop the emissions. I mean, that's a bigger right.
No, but you
get in
but
your
you
electric
to,
plane,
but,
Carol.
But you know what? When I talk about being smart, Carol.
Yeah.
If you start with something, if you're growing corn, it grows. It's capturing carbon. You process it. You use that protein for cow feed. Yes, you're emitting CO2, but actually, you can end up with negative CO2. Depending upon how the farmers till the land.
Right.
So there's ways that, you know, when I say being smart, it's trying to look and say, okay, with the tools we have, how can we not only eliminate emissions, but how can you turn it negative?
Can you talk a little bit about the power that's consumed in order to create hydrogen fuel cells? That came up in our panel.
Yeah.
At the New Jersey Institute of Technology earlier this week.
So uses power. I mean, to generate hydrogen, from electricity, it's probably a 50-60% efficient process. You know, if you think about that, boy, that sounds bad. I also will tell you, if you use batteries to back up the grid, it's about a 61% process when you look at self-discharge.
What do those percentages mean?
Oh, okay. So
for the non-engineering
part. Yeah, no problem, Tim. So how much power you get out for how much power you put in.
Okay.
And power out over power in equals efficiency.
This makes sense.
It's really,
so contextualize that for us. What's the most efficient power generation?
Oh.
Nuclear?
Nuclear is probably pretty efficient.
Or are we talking like 80s, 90s?
Yeah, you're probably talking that. But, you know, you have to also think about, Tim, the application, right? So it's great if, you know, let's say batteries. Batteries are not the right solution for heavy-duty vehicles.
Hmm.
They weigh too much.
Mm-hmm.
They take up too much room.
Mm-hmm.
You know, DHL told me one time if we use batteries for our panel truck, and they presented at another symposium we had, they said all they would be doing was carrying batteries around.
They have no room for stuff, right?
They have no room for stuff.
Wait a second. So that means that, you know, Tesla's Semi is not necessarily the right application?
I think I would not buy that product.
Interesting.
And you probably could justify that product for like a 150-mile run.
Mm-hmm.
But then you got to think about how much power you need. So there was work done at the Port of Long Beach, which, when you thought about how to power a truck, for one truck, it was more than the power that went into the station where they hold 50 trucks. I'm actually finding we have a lot of customers who want us to put hydrogen fuel cell systems in place to power electric vehicles because they can't get the power. So, you know, when I say it's not all easy, it's not all black and white. You need people who are really smart thinking about what's the right solution for the right application.
Just got 30 seconds, Andy. You know, what's going to be, what's top of mind for next year?
Oh, for, I think, from my perspective, we're going to do $1.4 billion in revenue. In 12 to 15 months, we're going to be positive because of operating income positive because of all the plants we're bringing online. That's the key to my business, getting those plants built to support all our applications.
Andy Marsh, come back soon.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stiefel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stiefel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stiefel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stiefel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
Yeah, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, getting a little excited here. Just about 9 minutes left in today's trading session. Down most on the NASDAQ, as you heard from Charlie, on a percentage basis. But we've got some big earnings coming your way. We're talking about Apple. We're talking about Amazon. We're talking about Intel, Pinterest, T-Mobile. But those big tech guys, man, they no doubt will affect the trade in some way or another.
Yeah, we're seeing Amazon and Apple down ahead of earnings. Yeah, Meta Platforms, of course, continuing to decline by more than 20% today. Let's try to understand, perhaps we have a really good guest on this. I know we do, actually, because he's talking about the return of value investing. Brian Frank is portfolio manager at Frank Capital Partners. He's with us right now in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio, taking a little trip up north from Miami. Brian, good to have you with us. How are you?
Good to be here, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, good to have you. So let's talk about this idea of a return to value. You're a value investor. But the last 10 years has you're chuckling, but it's been growth.
I'm chuckling to keep from crying. Okay. It's been a rough 10 years for value investing. But
is the regime shifted?
We're calling it the golden age of value investing that's about to come back here. This reminds me a lot of the beginning of my career in 1999. You had all those tech stocks running. You looked like an old dinosaur if you were buying things like JP Morgan and United Health. But then the next 10 years, I mean, even in that bear market, 2000, 2001, 2002, NASDAQ down 80%, the S&P down 40%, and you had value stocks going up. That sounds like a golden age. And what's happening today? You have the tech stocks down and you have some of the heavy value stocks going up. So from a valuation perspective, it's similar to 99, even after the 20% decline this year. But value stocks look good. They look really good.
That's what I want to ask you, Brian. So it's a valuation call on value versus elsewhere or versus growth, or is it a fundamental call on some of the names that are within the value space?
Probably a mixture of both. So top down, if you look at the Warren Buffett indicator, market cap to GDP, after this 20% decline, it's still 150%. So what that means in English, it's the same valuation, the market, as it was in 1999, which was not a great time to index, not a great time to be broad-based. the 10-year period from 2000 to 2010, stocks were flat. That blows up a lot of planning, you know.
But isn't the same market environment? Can you make an apples to apples case?
At least on valuation.
Say about past history and or past performance or lack thereof.
That's true. We always disclaim the past performance, but we also say history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. Mm-hmm. And what's rhyming right now is just the broad-based valuation there and the difference between value and growth. We're finding some value stocks. I got one in my portfolio. It's going to generate 18% of its enterprise value in cash next year. Compare that to the big stuff
next
in the
year?
S&P next year.
That's ticker NEX. It's a mobile hydraulic fracturing units that supply and are in great demand, as you wrote in your notes.
That's exactly right, yeah. And compare that to the big guys, you know, some of the big stocks in the S&P, you've got like a 4% free cash flow yield. So that's a big gap.
It's up 181% this year.
It is, and it's still cheap. That's the crazy thing about this.
But that's a real fundamental. Like, I think about the energy sector, right? If there's anything you could have banked on in the last couple of years, was energy.
Sure.
And almost anything related, it feels like.
You needed a little bit of nerves of steel, though. Like, as a value guy, you know, you're getting beat over the head every day with the growth stocks in 2020 and 2021. And oil goes negative during COVID. You really got to know your stuff and do the fundamental research to buy something like NexTier when, you know, when things are really in pain.
When did you start buying it?
We bought NexTier.
It's about $10 a share right now.
We bought it around $4 a share, I think.
That's a nice trade.
Late last year. Yeah.
This has been such a short time.
Again, yeah. I mean, it was kind of just a rocket that took off. But
so when do you sell it?
We sell it when the valuation is kind of in the middle of its historical range, and it's below its historical range still, just because so much cash is coming in. And the reason it kind of takes off like a rocket there is these companies start returning that cash to shareholders. So I know it's upsetting the administration.
Well, the buybacks, right? And I mean, that to me, I'm always kind of, I mean, we talk about this all the time. It's not like it's a fundamental story. It's just you're buying back shares and it's just basic math.
Sometimes it's that simple.
I know. And you're right. It does make sense, right, in terms of the payback for investors.
Hey, Brian, what happens if, you know, the Fed is able to tame inflation and then the Fed realizes it needs to lower rates in order to spur growth? What happens to your thesis?
Well, I think that's kind of why the market, it was rallying last week. You're starting to get the rumors of the Fed pause, and people are starting to get excited again. Maybe these growth stocks come back. But the way that I read that is the Fed's been talking tough for the whole year about inflation. We had a pretty bad CPI report. The last one surprised negatively again. And now they're talking pause. What that says to me is, what are they worried about? Maybe there's something wrong with the economy. So that's a growth scare. That's not good for growth stocks if they can't grow anymore.
Right, exactly. And this is why we try to, core PCE coming in pretty much as expected, but it's down from the prior read. And we thought there was maybe some optimism. One more name, because I love when we can talk stocks. KOF, Coca-Cola FEMSA.
Sure. I love to talk stocks too, Carol, all day long.
I know you do.
KOF is the largest distributor of Coca-Cola in the world.
Yeah,
their
huge
top markets are Mexico and Brazil. And what's interesting about that, you would think, oh, they're getting killed on the dollar. The Mexican peso and the Brazilian real are actually up on the year against the dollar. So you have a recession-resistant company. You have economies that are waking up from COVID, and they're doing great, and it pays a 4% dividend.
That's what I was just looking at the dividend. That was pretty significant. It's up about 14% if I look at the ADRs that trade here in the United States. So really seeing some outperformance. Can you, in 30 seconds, tell us about Opera Limited?
Absolutely. So you wouldn't think I'd be buying a tech stock as a value investor, but again, the numbers make sense on this one. This company just bought back 20% of its shares outstanding in an extremely short period of time. It's heavily insider owned, so it's a small float.
Yeah.
They actually have an authorization.
It's a $479 million market cap, small.
It is, and the float is tiny.
Yeah.
And they've authorized more buyback than there's actual float. So it's almost like a stealth take private. So I think it could really get squeezed higher because I'm not selling it at this price.
So it's not a fundamental play. It's just kind of what they're doing here, right, in terms of the buyback?
Well, fundamentally, it's strong too. So they own the Opera web browser, which is a great business.
Okay.
Every time you type in a search, they get paid. And that's going up this year. They actually have growth.
Love talking names. Love having you in studio. Brian, thank you so much.
Thanks, Carol.
Look forward to next time. Brian Frank, he's portfolio manager at Frank Capital Partners, joining us here in our Interactive Broker studio. His Frank Value Fund, by the way, up 4% in the past year, beating just about all of its peers in that value category.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.